copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
I know that by starting and choosing such a brave and topic to talk about building intimacy with God and growing closer together, I know that I'm maybe just going to scratch the surface, and it's an amazing topic, and I'm aware that He is the one that gets that, and He's the one that can open my heart and can use the words through me to touch your hearts. And that is my prayer, that is my desire this morning, and thank you again for this opportunity. So the topic is building intimacy with God and going closer together. A few months ago, a couple in their late 50s walked in my office. I was their last stop before signing divorce papers. For over an hour, she was reading all the issues they were facing and mostly the problems he needs to work on. When she went through her list, he only had one thing to say: "She's right." And then silence. What would you tell them? What would you ask? Where will you go from here? One thing is certain: being a therapist, being a psychologist, being pastor's wife, being in a church, sitting across from people like this, that for sure helped my prayer life. Because, no, I don't know, they're older than I am. They had experienced a lot of things in their life. You can see that she is wounded and broken. Where do you go from there? Do they need skills how to communicate better? Research shows over and over that happy couples do not talk to each other in any more skilled and insightful ways compared to unhappy couples. A client once commented, "I'm pretty good at talking, you know. I have lots of friends. I'm assertive and I'm a good listener. But when we get into these terrible long silences, trying to remember the points from our marriage training weekend is like trying to read how to pull your parachute manual when you are on a free fall." So what do I tell this couple? Why is it important? Why are the relationships so important to us? I'm a mom. I have a 22-year-old son, 17-year-old daughter, and 13-year-old daughter. To my 17-year-old daughter, sweet, loving girl that knows God and loves her parents, love is relationship and the worry number one. That is everything she can talk about, and she is worried and concerned. Well, she's a teenager, you will say. But U.S. and Canada rate a satisfying love relationship as their number one goal, ahead of financial success and satisfying career. What is there that we seek in relationship? Why are some couples content and some are not? Before we dig deeper into these questions, I would love to take you on a history excursion. I would love to introduce to all of you a person that influenced every one of our upbringing. I would love to talk a little bit about John Bowlby. Born in 1907, a son of baronet, raised in the upper class society, he was able to join his parents' dinner table when he turned 12, and then only for dessert. After boarding school, Bowlby volunteered to work in the residential schools for emotionally maladjusted children. After that experience, he went to medical school and took psychiatric training following 7 years of psychoanalysis. Later on, he will work with orphan and homeless children after the Second World War. His findings confirmed his belief in the reality of emotional starvation, that loving contact is as important as a physical nutrition. Well, all of us will say, duh, of course. But at that time, he was almost kicked out of the psychiatry board. That was the conventional wisdom at that time, held that cuddling by mothers and other family members created clingy, over-dependent youngsters who grew up into incompetent adults. Soon after that, attachment theory was born, first ridiculed and despised, eventually revolutionizing child-rearing methods in North America. It really influenced you and me in our life more than anything. That is the reason why our parents were holding us. Thanks to John Bowlby. Bowlby died in 1990. He did not live to see the second revolution sparked by his work, Application of Attachment Theory in Adult Love. Adults have the same need for attachments. I started digging and learning and finding more about attachment theory. I don't know if any one of you remembers, well, probably if you don't, I'm forgetting this, but last year I was talking about burnout. And I had an amazing opportunity this summer to be at Wheaton College, which means just, to me, like a candy store, books in library, and no family, and I don't have to cook, no kitchen, I can just read. And I just started reading more and more. Why the people? Why was somebody that just loves God and starts well just be drained and go through a burnout? Do they not trust God enough? Do they not read enough? What happens? And there is a one theory that actually the attachment theory can be applied in our churches in a way that we become adults. If we are loved, cared in our family, in our Christian homes, if we are held, if we are listened to, if we are cared for, that the chances of going through a burnout later on are much less. It was a study done actually in Australia, very interesting. And that really got me reading more and more. And that's the reason maybe why I decided to talk to you about John Bowlby. Because I think he influenced not much just the way that I'm going to hold my children, but the way I'm going to talk to my husband and we're going to care for each other and the way we're going to care for the people in the church that God gave us to serve. Dr. Sue Johnson, in her book, Hold Me Tight, presents the importance of healthy adult attachment, developing an emotionally focused therapy. It is translated even in Serbian, so I'm assuming that actually you can find it even in your own language. Focusing on creating a strengthening and emotional bond between partners where adults will be open, attuned, and responsive to each other. Attachment theory teaches us that our loved one is our shelter in life. When the person is emotionally unavailable or unresponsive, we face being out in a cold, alone, and helpless. Losing connection with our loved one jeopardizes our sense of security. The alarm goes off in the brain, in amygdala, and we don't think, we feel, we act. Professor Punksepp of the Washington State University called this primal panic. When we generally do one of these two things, we either become demanding and clinging in the effort to draw comfort and reassurance from our partner, or we withdraw and detach in an attempt to soothe and protect ourselves. So when does this alarm, attachment alarm, go off? It happens, Bowlby said, when we feel suddenly uncertain or vulnerable in the world, or when we perceive a negative shift in our sense of connection to a loved one, when we sense a threat or a danger to the relationship. Well, before we dig into complicated, important, and beautiful side of partners and relationship that make our life amazing or miserable, I would like to share with you some another interesting research done by psychologist Alfred Tomatis. And they were doing the research on a clinically depressed monks. After much of examination, researchers concluded that the group's of depression stemmed from their abounding twice-daily ritual of gathering to seek Gregorian chants. They had lost a sense of community and the comfort of singing together in harmony. Meeting and separation are key attachment moments. You know, kind of saying goodbye to your little kids and making sure when you come back that you say, you know, and saying, I will miss you, and then coming back and saying, I'm glad to see you again. The stressed partner sometimes complains bitterly about the loss of these small rituals. Emotional safety shapes physical synchrony, and a physical synchrony shapes emotional safety. When it comes to a relationship, there's a rule that any response is better than none. I mean, we learn and see that in our kids. They will rather get swat than not be seen by their parents. And actually, the worst way of neglecting someone and the worst way of abuse is not seeing someone. So when we get a no emotional response from a loved one, we are wired to protest. So Dr. Johnson calls this most widespread dance in relationship protest polka. Trying to get a response that connects and reassures. Well, let me go back to my couple in the office. After a long list of complaints that she had, in his quiet, intense observation of my rug in the office, she purses her lips together, looks at him, hisses, "This is the problem, right here. He never talks. I'm sick of it." Gender plays part here, though the roles vary with the culture and couples. But in Western society, women tend to be the caretakers of relationship. They usually pick up on distance sooner than their lovers, and they are often the pursuing, more blaming spouse. Men, on the other hand, have been taught to suppress emotional responses and needs and also tend to be problem solvers, which sets them up in a withdrawn role. So, what is a good dance if the polka is not a good one? When we hear each other attachment cry and respond with soothing care, that's what Dr. Johnson says. Well, what does that look like? For a good dance, and you'll see it in your outlines, I put certain things, and hopefully they will be helpful. And I'm sure that you and everyone who's been married for a couple of years could add some of the good moves in this dance. But for a good dance, we need to be open. We need to stay open to your partner even when you feel insecure. It often means being willing to struggle to make sense of your emotions so these emotions are not so overwhelming. We need to stay vulnerable. For a good dance, it is important to stay attuned. The excitement when 100 musical tones come together, when we listen to Bach, when every cell in your body responds, when emotional connection occurs in couples, something similar happens. Partners respond empathetically to each other when nerve cells mirror neurons. What is a nerve cell mirror in neurons? In 1992, neuroscientists discovered a mirror neurons. And how did they discover it? They were just watching, actually, the monkeys and mapping monkeys' brain. And the scientist was eating an ice cream. And what had happened, it showed that the monkey was excited like he was eating the ice cream. So that's the mirroring neurons. That happens with a couple that is attuned to each other. So his happiness, guess what, becomes my happiness. That means staying attuned. It's like watching experienced dancers dance, moving in synchrony without a spoken word. For a good dance, we need to be responsive. Tuning into your partner and showing that his or her emotions, needs, and fears have impact on you. Accepting and placing a priority on the emotional signals your partner sends, sending clear signals of comfort and caring their way. Even after more than a decade, I do find it very overwhelming working with couples. There are too many variables included. Looking through the lenses of attachment theory that I just kind of introduced to all of you, and you wonder, have they had healthy attachments in their home? Have their parents maybe read Dr. Spock's book, which I had it when I had my kids. I mean, Serbia is 20 years behind all of you. And decided not to pick up their youngster with the purpose of not raising a weak child. Have their parents danced polka too often? So now they learn that is maybe the only dance they could dance. As believers, we got a new family and a perfect father that loves us perfectly, giving us an opportunity to live and to love the same way he does. It is my desire to remind every one of us here that if we drink from the spring that humans offer, we will all eventually stay thirsty. Doesn't matter how many marriages and how many partners you had, you're going to stay thirsty. I'm convinced that God loves every one of us with depth, persistence, and intensity beyond imagination. Like the story of a prodigal son that should be called the story of a loving father. Divine love is absolutely unconditional, unlimited, unimaginable, and extravagant. Love is, and it should be, our identity and our calling. For we are children of love. If your parents failed, if your partner failed, if your spouse failed, if you failed, there is hope. Our Father is amazing. A few years ago, my husband and I went through a very hard time. We've been married, next year is going to be 25 years. So this was, I don't know, our 20 year anniversary. It was overwhelming. We were over and over coming to the springs that left us thirsty. And at that time, the only option that I felt I had was to just go away for a little time. I mean, the only option that was legal to deal in my chaos, it was just to give him time. And I actually did something I've not done since we got married. I went to be alone for 2-3 days. I went on a weekend with Jesus. After a few days, I was in love again with the lover of my soul. I was soon at home. Different. I was loved. I was cared. Of course I knew that. I became a believer when I was 18. I heard about him. He changed my life. What happened to me? Why did I think that my husband should give me something that he can't? It is meant for us to fail. It is. So that we can come to the one that can replenish, that can love us. When he tells me how beautifully I'm created, how what he thinks about me, what he has for me, when he tells me, when I shower in his love, guess what? If my husband doesn't see me, the divine, the lover of my soul, sees me. If my husband doesn't see that my hair is different or that somebody very powerful, and I just have to say this, I mean, being a woman and a speaker, do you know what is the first name that somebody for the first time gave to our God? It is Hagar, a woman, a slave, and she named him the God that sees. The way our God sees, he sees us, sees every one of us in our vulnerability and brokenness and nakedness, and he loves us. He gave the most precious thing to every one of us. So my dear brothers and sisters, wouldn't that change you? Wouldn't that change your marriage? So I call it a different kind of lovemaking that I encourage every one of you. In your notes, you'll see, please, the most important thing you can give to your spouse is solitude and inner silence you're going to have with a divine lover. The talk you're going to have with him. The listening in a communion of worship, confession, and celebration. The dominant image throughout Scripture of God's loving relationship with his people is the image of the faithful bridegroom betrothed and the wayward bride betrothed. The creation week culminates with a wedding. The first miracle, it is in the wedding. The New Testament marriage is explicitly described as imaging Christ and his church. So, we are called for a higher call. It is not about, is my husband the one, as Ephesians 5 says, is he the one? There are moments when he is not worthy of my respect, that I'm not worthy maybe of being loved. But it is not about us. It is about him. And us representing the amazing picture of divine love, the lover and his church. Together, married or single, we are the recipients of the high calling to function as images of the loving, united, Trinitarian God and the lovingly, joyously, utterly faithful bride of Christ, betrothed to God, Christ, united together as his bride, the church. Thank you.